Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Lycanography, the podcast that codifies the canon of films from one of the world's greatest animation studios, Leica. I'm Michael Leader.
And I'm Steph Watts, and we've seen a lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm dying to talk about them.
So join us on our quest into the glorious world of Leica. Welcome back, friends. There's been a great schism in the church that is Ghibli Attack. Up until now, we've had the selectionary following the career of Henry Selick, and now he's parting ways with the studio, Leica Studios, and we're going to be following them, their films. This is what, you know, this is like Christianity. This is like Catholicism versus Protestantism. Has your world been rocked, Jake?
Yes, it certainly has. I'm now thinking what on earth the reformation of this podcast is going to be. But it's fascinating to go on this journey, and it has made me think, like, down the line with the podcast, what other bold adventures can we go on where we're no longer bound to a single filmmaker or a single studio? We can go off grid, as it were. But yeah, very, very excited to be jumping in to the Lycanography, even though I suppose we kind of already had. That's why we had to do it. They are so entwined. But with a new Henry Selick film coming later this year, which of course we will revisit this series down the line, it'd be amazing to see how much the paths of Selick and Leica diverted at this point as well. So when we do get a new Leica stop motion film and a new Henry Selick stop-motion film, without them being involved, how will one feel like the other or not? Will something feel missing? Will something feel more interesting?
We're almost at the stage, I think, will this year be the year where the majority of our previous miniseries focuses have a new film out? Mm. We'll have a new cartoon saloon film in the mix as well as a new Selick, a new Leica. I love this idea, Jake. You're tempting me now. I love a series of sort of rock editorial drawings called the Rock Family Tree series, which an artist, I believe, called Peter Frame put out over many, many years, where he would chart where a band was formed and they split off and formed other bands and then come together, and you'll have Fairport Convention version number 20, who are still touring today, for example. So you're tempting me now to do a mini-series like that, which is almost like a family tree, where it's just splintering off in many directions. But for now, let's stick with just the two branches of Selick and Leica. Steph, are you still on firm ground here? You were there back in the day with Nightmare Before Christmas and the screaming doorbell. Is Leica firm ground for you or new territory?
Well, once again, in this miniseries, I've lied because I have not seen a lot of them. I've never seen Paranorman. So this is new ground for me. But a very, very pleasant experience. So I'm excited to talk about it.
It's So yes, it's getting spooky here. In fact, actually, we're recording this in summer. This film came out in summer, even though it's a very autumnal, spooky film. So let's pretend there's some Halloween vibes going on as we talk about Paranorman. But first, Steph, please cue us up with some synopsis.
Norman Babcock never asked to see the ghosts of dead people in his daily life, but his strange inherited talent is now the only thing standing between the cursed town of Blythe Hollow and an all-out zombie apocalypse.
Steph, I've got to say, if you ever become like a scout leader or something, you've got a great voice for doing the campfire ghost story, like the somberness to Norman Babcock never asked to see dead people.
The Leica and Selleck synopses are really lending themselves to that kind of campfire ghost story vibe, aren't they? Definitely. Maybe if I have a career change, that's where I'll be.
Yeah.
A summer camp reading ghost stories. But Michael, what's the gathered round the summer campfire. Tell us some context for Paranorman.
We'll be here right till the embers die down for context, as always. So last week, where did we land? Okay, Coraline, big hit, critical success. I think for Focus Features, the distributor, it was their biggest hit that wasn't Brokeback Mountain. So a really unlikely success for a stop motion film. Henry Selick was finally on top, Oscar nominee, award winner, all sorts. Where did he go next? Well, the sad thing is, we know this from our present day perspective, he didn't finish or release a new film for over a decade after Coraline. The film that will finally break that drought, Wendell the Wild, as Jake said, will be out later this year. But it was announced that Selick was leaving Leica in October 2009, so when the film was still on the awards circuit, and apparently Selick's contract expired and they just couldn't negotiate a satisfactory renewal, so off he went. And as you said, this is where the paths diverge, the Selectionary and the Lichenography part ways. Selick goes on, he forms a new company called Cinderbiter Productions, and signs a deal with Disney and Pixar to develop stop motion features. That might be news to most people listening, and that is because nothing actually came of that, sadly. But we'll talk more detail about that Disney and Pixar period of Selick's career later in the miniseries when we wrap up. So we'll bid farewell, a fond farewell to Henry Selick, just for now, because we'll focus our attentions on Leica Studios. So while Coraline was nearing the end of production, Leica unveiled their slate of development projects, and that included an adaptation of Alan Snow's kids book series Here Be Monsters. More on that next week. That becomes Box Trolls. But it also featured an original idea they were working on called Paranorman. The original plan was for them to have like a feature a year, which is incredibly ambitious for a stop motion studio. I think in the end now this kicks off like a film every 2 year kind of routine for them, which is still, if you think about the gaps between Nightmare Before Christmas, James the Giant Peach and Coraline, that's still incredibly industrious. Travis Knight is back. He's producing, serving as lead animator, as well as being the sort of head honcho of the studio. We're talking a similar scale of production here, you know, in terms of the massive warehouse they're working in, the number of sets, the kind of 300, 400 craftspeople involved. But there were some key new additions, and the big innovation this time around is they have colour 3D printers. So we talked last time about how 3D printers helped really revolutionise the process of creating these the sets, the props, the puppets. But now it cuts down not just hours and hours and hours of hand sculpting, but hours and hours and hours of hand painting on top of that. This is where we get ridiculous and we talk about the massive numbers. So that means that the lead character, Norman, for example, had apparently 8,800 faces to choose from, with 1.5 million different possible expressions, because each face is made up of 78 individual pieces. So let's see if you can count through all 1.5 million of those expressions frame by frame in this film. To put that into context, so 1.5 million expressions for Norman, 300,000 for Coraline, and Jack Skellington only had a mere 800. But then he didn't have eyes, so, or skin, or a nose.
And this is kind of... been popularized now, and this is within stop motion, this is becoming so much of the norm, like with like Wes Anderson using 3D printing with his, and there was the Charlie Kaufman film Anomalisa, which made a big fuss out of 3D printed and kind of made a like an uncanniness out of the 3D printing of it as well.
Yes, and this is something maybe we'll talk about this in the review section. It's where the technology really starts to make stop motion really advanced in a way that we'd never seen before. Henry Selick, I think all the way back on our Nightmare Before Christmas episode, he said he wanted to use the most advanced camera technology to enliven something that was very old technology, which is hand-crafting puppets. And now, actually, the technology to create the puppets is just as advanced as the cameras and everything else they're using. And I suppose as we go on through Leica, as they're making these big movies, we should ask whether this still feels like what stop motion was earlier in the miniseries, and whether this is being pushed more towards maybe what we see elsewhere in animation. The directing duties for Paranorman fall to two people, both veterans from other areas of animation, two British blokes. There's Chris Butler, who came up with the idea, and he wrote the screenplay as well as co-directing. He was the storyboard supervisor and I think an uncredited head of story type role for Coraline. But before that, he had storyboard credits on the likes of Corpse Bride, Tarzan 2, the straight-to-video film, the Tigger movie, the Mr. Bean animated series in the 90s. Remember his name, because we're going to hear more from him throughout this miniseries, because he becomes one of the key Leica creatives. Chris Butler was making his directorial debut, but he was paired with Sam Fell, who was more of a veteran. He'd been working with Aardman Animations throughout the 1990s on lots of shorts. He then developed and directed Aardman's CG feature Flushed Away that came out in 2006. He came up with the idea for that film, and Aardman liked to just sort of field ideas from anyone around the studio, and so they developed that. So he really rose through the ranks there. He also directed or co-directed the CG film Tales of Despero, which came out in 2008. So he's sort of, you know, got a good couple of credits under his belt, both in CG rather than stop motion, but had worked in a lot in that before then. This film had a much starrier cast of Hollywood voices, like Anna Kendrick, Casey Affleck, John Goodman, Christopher Mintz-Plasse, Leslie Mann, Cody Smith-McPhee in the lead role as Norman. Amazing. That's an amazing career arc for him, from child star to The Power of the Dog last year. But this film, Paranorman, it was very much envisioned as a zombie movie for kids. At least initially, that's what the development pitch was. And it was continuing on from the spooky, eerie vibe of Coraline. But when on that episode, we talked about how there was this sort of pressure from various quarters, make it more scary, make it less scary, make it more commercial. And this one definitely has a more commercial leaning by design. And it captures, I think, the dual purpose at the heart of the studio at this point, and maybe it goes to define the studio afterwards. There's a quote that sticks out for me in all the reading I've done from the piece that was reporting on that development slate in 2008, and it's from Fiona Kenshall, who was the VP in charge of acquisitions and development. And she said, "We're to the left of Pixar and to the right of Nightmare Before Christmas." So they're really trying to pitch it both ways as being, I suppose, what does Pixar mean at this point? It's maybe a little bit of Up, I suppose, but then Toy Story, Monsters, Inc., but then Nightmare Before Christmas is still this extreme. We'll never go as extreme as Nightmare Before Christmas. And then when Paranorman actually came out, Travis Knight said something that I think also captured this duality. He said that he thought that the film closely mirrored the sensibility of the many artists at the studio. He said, "We are the outcasts. We are the misfits. And everyone here has an extraordinary gift, like Norman does." But he also then said in the same interview, "We always want to grow in every way possible. We fully expect that Paranorman will be a bigger, more commercially successful film than Coraline." So this mixture of like artistry, spooky kid, weird kid artistry, but also commercial ambition. The film cost $60 million, so similar budget level to Coraline. It was released in the States, as I said, August 2012. So this is actually a 10th anniversary episode for Paranorman. And it makes just over $100 million, so a really nice amount, but just falls short of Coraline. And it fell short of Travis Knight's expectations as well, at the box office at least. But it was a really well-received film by the critics. And like Coraline, it was nominated for Best Animated Feature at the Oscars. So that leads us to quiz time. Any guesses for what it was up against?
2012.
Well, I guess it came out 2012, so this is Animated Feature Oscars 2013.
2012.
So a couple of tips for you. Pixar won that year.
What was Pixar making in 2012? Toy Story 3 is 2010. And then after Toy Story 3 is... what
was there, like a Zootropolis in there, or
it's a bit early for that?
Well, it's definitely, yeah, it's not a franchise one. What do you have to be if you're watching all these scary films?
Oh, is it Brave?
Yeah, the film. Yeah.
Well, I thought Brave was before Toy Story 3 for some reason.
Oh, so right, Brave won. A film by a director we've had on this podcast, actually, but we've not covered this studio's films yet. Stop motion. Well, is it stop motion again?
A director who's been on this podcast, who films we haven't covered. Now that is a riddle.
I've mentioned the studio barely 3 or 4 minutes ago.
And it's stop motion, but not stop motion.
I think this is,
it's Aardman.
Returning to stop motion.
Yeah.
For a very long title. Can you get the whole title, Jake?
Of an Aardman film from 2000.
Has an exclamation mark in it.
The Pirates in an Adventure with Scientists.
And then returning, so there's another Disney movie from around this period.
Oh dear.
Lots of video game references.
Wreck-It Ralph.
And the final one is the Spectre, the Ghost. At the banquet of this podcast,
Tim Burton's
Tim Burton's film of that time,
Frankenweenie.
Yeah, so what a weird category.
That's a weird collection of films.
And yeah, Brave won. I feel like Brave from Pixar is probably
this is better than Brave
until that sort of the sequel period. That felt like the Pixar film that didn't exist.
Have you not encountered The Good Dinosaur, Michael? He's good.
Of course. Sorry, that's the Pixar film that doesn't exist that I've forgotten existed.
Yeah.
But that's by the by. One day we'll do our Pixar series, will we? We'll see.
Oh, he said it now.
For now.
Can't take it back.
For now, we've got to get back to the lichenography, and we've got to talk about Paranorman in the review section. Jake and Steph, over to you.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? for me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I suppose the big prompt for this post-schism iconography episode is this is, having talked about Coraline, where it was Henry Selick with the son of a billionaire and his studio allowed to make the film he always dreamed of making. This is Leica working without Henry Selick. So, let's tackle that then. So, Jake, what strikes you here about Paranorman? This is Leica without Selick.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that they are kind of talking about their commercial goals. And it's funny that, like, by becoming more commercial, they become less commercial. And it's nice to think that people really came out in their droves to watch Coraline. Because I don't think this film is as interesting as Coraline or as good as Coraline, and that is because it wants to be more of a mainstream film. And I wonder if they kind of banked on there being as you mentioned, a zombie film for kids, that the crowd of kids that would be excited about that is perhaps not as big as maybe they hoped. I think the film is really well crafted. Its visuals are lovely, its music's lovely. I think the story is just fine. I don't think it gets to as many intriguing depths as Coraline does, or as Selick is interested in as well. Like, this is pretty straightforward stuff. Like, the emotional journey isn't really that complicated. It doesn't exist in too many grey areas. But the thing that it does have going, which I found really refreshing compared to what's come before, and I won't say this, like, obviously we have to admit to Monkey Bone's existence, but this film is funny, and it's interested in making jokes and gags, and there's a lot of visual humour to it. Monkey Bone attempts to do that and fails, but this film is kind of breezes along on a a lot of highs of humour, which I was happy to encounter.
I wonder if that's where they're seeing this more commercially viable element to the film, because I think it definitely fits in with that kind of aimed at kind of children element, where, you know, you have like a lot of Pixar films are taking you on a journey, but they are like stuffed with gags at the same time. And I feel like this is maybe more commercial in that aspect, that there are a lot of kind of visual jokes and a lot of like jokes chucked into the script. But I think, like, yeah, world-wise and story-wise, I wouldn't necessarily think that this is the film that's going to kind of rule over the summer of the cinemas that you're going to take everyone to go and see. Because I think it is still pretty kind of niche. And if you're making, you know, a film about outcasts with your kind of outcast misfit crew in the same kind of sense that Henry Selick and Tim Burton were making Nightmare Before Christmas, then you're not necessarily going to appeal to everybody commercially. I think going forward with Leica is something that I think is a bit of a difficult spot that they're in. And it doesn't mean that their films are like not enjoyable or like not good, because they're like artistically amazing. But that kind of, yeah, aim to be like commercially successful that Travis Knight is talking about, I don't think is necessarily like how this film came off.
Well, and like, they struck, it was lightning in a bottle with Coraline, where you do have that outsider thing that is incredibly beautiful, that is beloved by critics, that makes loads of money. And looking ahead to the future of Leica films, that we don't hit that again. They feel like maybe they're constant, rather than trying to go back to formula. They want to go and kind of prove themselves without Selleck, maybe. And it's like that they brought in this legend to set them up, that like they can lay a foundation from the studio, and rather than build on a Selleck identity, they want to craft something for themselves. Credit to them, that's great for them to do that. It's just unfortunate that if you start with one of the best to ever do it and you're then trying to get to that high, it's very, very hard to reach.
It strikes me, this, I'll flash back to maybe a very grumpy thing that we've talked about in previous episodes, where Hayao Miyazaki has talked about this younger generation who all they know is anime. And he says, you know, that's why he doesn't like anime. He doesn't like anime fans, because anime became this all-encompassing worldview and sensibility, so that you only then had filmmakers responding to the art form, rather than his generation who would go and read literature and be political and all this other stuff. I feel that's the strongest shift for me, and it's almost from the very first frame. Henry Selleck is definitely of the spooky kids generation. He was brought up on Ray Harryhausen and late night horror films and all this stuff, but he would never do something as straightforward as, here is a cheesy old horror film in my film. Mm-hmm. The way he would do it would be, he would have homages to different forms of animation, where you're like, wow, that cutout sequence is incredible, or wow, that whole sequence that looks like it's an Edward Gorey drawing of a surrealist short story or whatever. That is his composite worldview, whereas the approach to horror and a lot of the tropes in this film are sort of gags and Easter eggs and references, similarly actually to Wreck-It Ralph, similar film of the same year, where it feels like the people behind this have just grown up on these films and they love the films, and for them it's more a case of, whereas let's say Henry Selleck had in Coraline lots of first person shots, which may be a reference to Halloween, landmark horror film with lots of first person point of view shots tracking through houses. In this one, they'll have a kid with a phone who has the Halloween theme as his ringtone. It's a very different marked shift and pushes it more into that commercial territory. And I think this is a very fun film, a really well-made film, but it does almost immediately, and this is what's great about watching these films in sequence, and we're sort of collapsing 30 years of history into the space of 8 episodes. It feels very quickly like the sort of film you could probably get from any other studio at this point, in terms of its tone.
Oh yeah, tonally for sure. And I think they kind of lay out their goals with it from before the first frame of animation, is when you see the title card, and they're designed it in kind of boxy framing and old style fonts to fit, to look like a B movie, to look like a 70s horror. And that is saying, in a way, to your audience, think of this film like you might think of those. Like, this, don't go into this thinking this is high art, this isn't Coraline. Like, we're showing you from the very first moment that this is cheap and fun, even if it's not cheap and not a huge amount of fun, but to give you a gauge for your expectations going into it. Which I actually thought was quite smart, and so I like it, kind of felt assured going into this, like, oh, like, you don't need to be kind of freeze framing this all the time and overthinking it. You certainly could, but it was quite refreshing as well, just to have something so breezy and not so obsessed. And we mentioned this about maybe Fantastic Mr. Fox or Wes Anderson approach, where you've got to be appreciating everything that's in the frame all the time.
That's funny, because I had the opposite.
Oh, really?
Reaction to it. I think this is a similar thing to when we talked about The Mitchells versus The Machines with Mike Reander. You just want to pause every single shot, like wide shot of the house, of the town, of like all the surroundings, because there's so much like stuffed in there. And I think, like you're saying, Michael, like this is, you know, it's not necessarily referencing older kind of techniques of animation, but it is referencing pop culture like all the time. And like so much of that visually is just in there, and you just want to like pause on Norman's bedroom and just like look around the room and see what like kind of little jokes and things they've stuffed in there. My galaxy brain take is that this is creepy Gilmore Girls.
Oh, because I always hear it as Stars Hollow.
Yeah, because it's, yeah, you know, the Blythe Hollow, Stars Hollow, you're in like a New England tiny town, everybody knows each other. You have those, like, I think they've like nailed Norman as a kid at that time, because it is like the constant pop culture references and like the way that maybe, you know, an 11-year-old will engage with something they like is by just referencing like everything, like having the ringtone theme, or like his friend running around with the little Jason hockey mask and that kind of stuff. But also Alex Borstein is in this as a voice of the drama teacher, and she's in Gilmore Girls, so that's my
Who's Luke?
The uncle that's in, he's in Gingham all the, not Gingham, he's
flannel
in,
guy.
He's in flannel, well, he's running around. Yeah, he's a bit weird. He's a bit of an outcast. That's, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I like it.
But yeah, no, I do think the kind of, it is definitely like lighter in tone. And I think, yeah, I guess like you said, Jake, less kind of obsessed with the kind of the high art of it all. But I think there is like so much visually in there to look at and enjoy, and
should we have a roll call of visuals that are that you found arresting, because there's so much stuff that I thought was that really fits this film and is still and is totally unique as well. Like, I really love the monsters made out of toilet roll. It's like, that is absolutely perfect for an 11-year-old horror film. That, of course, you like, toilet roll is a thing that you always use at Halloween to turn into a mummy or throw at houses or whatever. I mean, we'll make a spooky monster out of toilet roll. But the way that the toilet roll moves in the air is amazing. And so they are really kind of having fun with what to do in this world. What other bits came to mind for you that you're thinking, oh, that is really good?
I liked, actually, in the bathroom scene where he's visited by the ghost of his uncle who comes up through the toilet. Yeah. Just before that, the tiles on the wall start kind of rippling, which I thought was, like, such an amazing effect. And just one actual piece of movement that's, like, really everyday that I just really enjoyed was Norman cleaning his locker. So he gets to school and somebody's written, like, freak on his locker, and he kind of sighs and like gets a little spray can and kind of cloth out of his locker, and then he's kind of reaching up on his tiptoes to spray the can and wipe it, and it's just such a smooth and realistic piece of animation for something that is so normal in a film where, you know, he's jumping off of bits of pavement that are flying in the air, and there's a witch in the sky, and there's zombies moving. It's such a kind of small everyday action that really kind of blew me away in a weird way. I mean, we've talked on this podcast series already about like how do you make a worm move like a real thing, but I don't think we've fully talked about just how human all of the characters actually move.
It's like these little micro movements and conversations hit, like, I think there's an evolution in this film. I think Coraline is stunning, but it's kind of hermetically sealed within its weird little world, and you never feel like that's our world. I think this does position itself as more like our world, and the way that characters move are more like us. So Paranorman and his friend with the curly hair, shout out to all the hair in the film. Hair is amazing, like the flat top, the curls, the Norman's hair that looks like a tree that's been cut in half. but the way that kids move, like there's a bit where, is he called Neil, the friend? Yeah.
Yeah.
The kind of slightly shy but excited kids will take one arm and like awkwardly like hold the elbow of their other arm and have a little wobble. And it's like, you didn't need to put that in. They can just stand there. But that real focus on like, how do kids move if they're feeling these emotions at this time? And like just the whole conversation that they have in his back garden when they're throwing a stick to an invisible dog, and there's all these ums and ahs and this swaying, and it feels like very kind of authentically lived movement for 3D printed tiny little creatures.
And I suppose that brings up something we go into a bit more depth about the craft behind this, because for me there is that tension between the increasing potential of what stop motion can do with all these 3D printed puppets, the increasing use of CG to sort of clean up or to create the environments around them, and the design. And I there are elements of the design in this that I do love. The character designs are so at times caricatured and grotesque, but they all do exist in the same world. And it's the sort of thing where it's only really when you see them stood in a lineup that you realise how weird the character designs are. And the thing that struck me this time, which I just so delightful, I loved the design of the family car that you see at the end, because it's you know, the family dynamic is the dad is this sort of big bloke and there's a sort of stick-thin mum, and when they're sat side by side in the car, the roof is actually slanted to show sort of like that size dynamic in the relationship. Just those sorts of gentle, slightly grotesque caricaturing in the designs are really delightful. But let's talk about that craft then, because Akira Kurosawa, as we've quoted on this podcast, has said that, you know, Miyazaki's such a good animator, he should make a live action film someday. And that's always the spectre hanging over animators, you know, that animation is somehow subservient to live action. But for this, why is this in stop motion when it could be in another form? Does it have a reason to be in stop motion?
I think that's a good question. It would certainly be a cheaper story to tell in live action, because schlocky 70s horror, there was so much of it because it was the cheapest thing to be made. So it is quite strange to then do an homage to that in what is probably the most expensive thing to be making it in. But then also the question with why animation is also why not?
But then also why this form of animation? Something that really strikes me, particularly in the opening scenes, when you have what could be ripped out of the establishing scenes of any other animated film or any other sort of live action coming of age movie, of the kid on the walk to school, all those tracking shots through streets and the camera placement, the sort of the tracking his feet and then opening up on these sets of streets and crossings and the high streets and everything. I really felt that shift from somebody who, like Henry Selick, is used to using smaller sets and getting the most out of them, to somebody who's worked in, as Sam Fell had, worked in CG, where you create these larger environments and you can move in a full environment and mimic a live action camera in that way. And it really was marked for me. And I don't know why. This is always purely emotional and personal and subjective, right? Where you think that seems like it could, yeah, that's a different sort of film. But let's talk about that then, in terms of the environments they create. Because as you said, Coraline exists in its own hermetically sealed world. It does have almost a rim of fog around it, where if you walk away from the mansion, you go into this white negative world. It does have a scene in the shops at the local town, but this is one where it feels like they build a whole town, right? That's a big change in the scale.
Yeah, and I think the building that wider world kind of answers your question about why are you doing it in this form? Because I think the issue, if you have a low budget horror, will be when you want to get to your villains and you want to get to your monsters. If you're shooting everything without not much money in the real world, it all kind of looks like our world. and then you throw something in that's not of our world, it looks alien and probably cheap, and your suspension of disbelief goes because you've shown us a thing that doesn't exist. And they've spent so much time here building out that world and the visual language of that world, the geography of it, so we can kind of imagine what goes down this street and that street, and it all looks a certain way. So when you do introduce these like incredible, the cloud spirits in the woods, which I have no idea how they're doing them, it's just like astonishing work. They feel at home in this world because of everything that they set up in the regular, non-mystical version of it.
I think short of, you know, Netflix making a Stranger Things Paranorman spin-off, it's just not something that would still have the same kind of magical element in live action.
The answer now, and this again, we're getting to this sentimental thing, I guess, and maybe it could be generational, maybe it's just sort of what films you like growing up. So the answer to that question, Jake, of how they did it is almost always VFX now. It used to be some crazy trick where it's actually popcorn that's been painted in this way, or they just got really tiny, you know, needles to knit, or something. Now they're using so much VFX in here, which is means they can do things they've never done before. But for some of us who are maybe our purists, or maybe we are sentimental, as I say, tied to this idea that stop motion is a form that should have necessary boundaries, and to innovate within them is what the magic is. This is where, in some ways, the most magical moments of this film in terms of the craft is in the closing credits. And this might be something we'll come back to with the rest of the Leica films, where they pull back the curtain in the closing credits and you see the craft. In this one, it's showing a Norman puppet from like design to mold to pouring the mold to then, you know, the individual bits of painting and dressing. And it goes back to me, something I don't think we mentioned in the Coraline episode, where because these faces, these 3D printed faces, have all of these individual parts, there are natural sort of seams and cracks between them. You mentioned Anomalisa, Jake. That's a film that shows those cracks, the way it looks like they're fake faces. Henry Selick, in Coraline, I think he said he wanted to keep those in to show that they weren't real. And he was, I think, overruled by maybe Travis and I think maybe even Phil Knight saying, no, we should digitally erase them to make them seem more lifelike and real. And it feels like, I think, the Leica project is to create this perfectly designed and realised world where you forget you're watching stop motion.
Yes, but you don't have the equivalent of Aardman, where you're looking at thumbprints in every frame. Yeah.
I think that is something interesting to keep an eye on as we go along, because I feel like with some of the later films, almost the only way you know it's stop motion is those like post-credit sequence where they show you how they've done it. And then I guess, yeah, that does raise the question, like, why spend a year making a film in this way if you're not going to see how it's done? Like on the screen, if you don't have those kind of like handmade elements very present. But I think you still get it in this one. I think with the kind of designs of the buildings, and you know, everything's like a little bit wonky, and all the characters kind of look like a toothpaste tube that's been squeezed in certain areas. Like, I think you still get that handmade element, but they're definitely like teetering on the edge of it just being so perfect.
And we'll talk about Fantastic Mr. Fox on a Patreon episode, but that's one where, you know, Wes Anderson wanted to keep that roughness in there. I'd also compare it with when Tim Burton returns to stop motion. That's a bit too clean at times as well. But again, it's a sentimental attachment, but also I think part of what Henry Selick views animation as, which is animation should call attention to its craft in order to inspire the people. You know, he's in his films, he's always cramming in somebody, even within the film, doing some craft of their own, to make it even more meta, rather than just creating an animated film where you can still get a sense of that craft, but really you should probably go and pick up the Making of art book to get a sense of that real craft, because there's some amazing artists involved in this, you know, as there has been on every film so far. One person we should shout out that we've had on this podcast in the past was Ross Stewart, who had worked on Secret of Kells and Song of the Sea, and then moved over to Leica to do concept art before going back to Cartoon Saloon for Wolfwalkers. And do you see maybe a Ross Stewart vibe at any point in this film? A Cartoon Saloon-y vibe in any scenes, Jake?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think the descending into the woods where you find a youthful, white, glowing female character who seems to be from a folktale, that's an extremely Cartoon Saloon thing. And even the design of the witch, when she's in her kind of white, glowing Mr. Burns alien phase, is extremely Kells. It's well, I think you've essentially got a character like that in all of the folklore trilogy from Cartoon Saloon. That kind of mythic, ethereal, sprite-like figure in the woodland. And if you go over to Ross Stewart's website, rossstewart.net, and we'll post these on our Twitter as well, you can see his early concept art for that character. And you might as well just copy and paste it over to the lookbook for Secret of Kells. You can really see it in there. And so it's really interesting to see from that what a Cartoon Saloon stop motion film could look like too. But just thinking of the witch, and that obviously that's the finale of the film. Like, moving away from the craft of this thing and how it's been made, what do you actually think of the story? And the characters within it, and its message. What message does it have, Steph?
So Norman has these kind of visions, omens, where he's kind of transported back to kind of early New England, where kind of witch trials are going on. And I think as that unravels, I think you get a really powerful moment where they realise that the witch is actually just like a child and not this kind of scary, ugly kind of monster that they've immortalised as a town statue. I think it's not as like black and white as we might think it is, because you have a lot of discussion about kind of forgiveness for the people who actually decided to kind of have her killed.
It's a kid's film about forgiving people for child murdering.
I think this is like where I don't see it as maybe for kids. I appreciate it for not being like, you know, be kind to everyone and like that kind of very basic message that it could very easily come off with, because I think you have kind of three or four points of view that all kind of converge on that final scene and like whatever the lesson is from it. I think it's very interesting as like a film about tolerance and how far we have come or have not come in like 300 years, that it kind of like goes in cycles, and people are still kind of reactionary and act out of fear, and it's not right, but people do it anyway. I think I was quite surprised about that element of it.
It has to pull off a couple of really tricky moves, because it's probably presuming that kids watching this know witches and maybe know the history of American witches and witch trials and everything like that, that iconography. But then it has to then probably teach them a little bit about how it actually was this abuse of power, this mob mentality, often victimizing young women and all these other things as scapegoats. But then it has to then make another turn where you have zombies are scary, but then the zombies are revealed to not be scary. And it has this sense of bullying all the way throughout as well. And it ends with this young girl who was in some ways bullied by the ultimate bullies, which were the puritanical Americans of the of early American history. Which I think, as Jake said, it sort of lands into this sort of tricky territory of either seeking to forgive those abusive people in power, or showing them to be a figure of fun. So when it's finally revealed that the zombies are you know, not actually the scary thing, they're powerless. It's mixing up probably one of the most sort of historic abusive power structures within white American history with schoolyard bullies, which is very simplified, maybe too simplified for this story. But the actual very ending, which reminds me a bit of everything from Turning Red to Boy and the Beast, the idea of it all hinges on this very anime thing of like a young kid with powers they can't control and having to somehow appeal to the innocence and the friendship at the heart of that and reach out to them. I thought that sequence works really well at the end. But it does have quite a facile overall point of don't judge people by their reputation or how they look or a book by its cover. Be kind and be tolerant, which maybe doesn't seem so sophisticated, maybe.
Yeah.
Jake, what did you think? So you hinted a little bit there about forgiving the Puritans.
Yeah, I think it... Structurally, I don't think it's like its rhythms are totally enjoyable. I think perhaps like a horror film, it suffers from kind of being a bit drab at the start as it starts to kind of put all its chess pieces out. And so I think the first 25 to 30 minutes of the film aren't particularly fascinating or entertaining. I think it's perfectly nice. But I think with Coraline, which is a film in which, again, not a huge amount happens at the start, because that world is so fascinating and so different, that's what kind of carries you through it. Because this world is like, it's fun, but as I said, it's not so far away from our own. You don't feel propelled through it just because of the open top bus tour through the world. And then I think the middle is where it gets a bit confused, and that's where there's too much thrown at it. And so you get like, you've got to assemble, you bring in all the characters and they're all quite shouty and have their own dynamics. And then you've got the stuff that's happening in the past. You've got the stuff that's happening in the present. You're flipping between the past and the present. I should say the scene transitions between the past and present are amazing.
Yeah.
Like really, really clever stuff. And so it's that middle bit where it's just like it's throwing too much at the wall. And then when it does, if you could strip that back a bit more and focus on that relationship between him and the witch and maybe get rid of kind of a few of the tertiary characters and dramas, I think you'd maybe get a bit more emotion in that back end as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, I didn't feel like that emotionally attached to it much that was going on. In a way, I felt that more than the film about tolerance, this was a film about creativity.
Mm.
And what I could see in Norman was the thing that so many people have, whatever form they're working in, which is this idea of seeing a thing in your head so clearly and trying to get other people to understand it and see it themselves. And in a way, that is, well, that's filmmaking too. And this whole drama that you've got to go through is just to try and get people to understand a thing. And obviously that doesn't have to be art. That can be anything. It's just anyone feeling any feeling. But it was, to me, that's where, particularly as the finale of the film revolves around essentially someone telling a once upon a time story. This was about trying to get that story that you can see and get other people to see it with you.
Yeah, it's on the cusp of something, I think.
Mm.
I think that it also falls down where they rely a little bit on tropes of the genre. So they've decided it's going to be a coming-of-age film with a kid in a school is like their focus. And it's something that really rubbed me up the wrong way growing up, where there'd be the sort of waspy, able-bodied middle-class white kid as the main character, and then they'd have an overweight friend, and then probably a sort of maybe ethnically ambiguous friend with braces and glasses as their other friend. And that world and milieu is just sort of copied and pasted from so many other TV shows and films there, where it's adding those things in for a sake of sort of character diversity, maybe, but it's feeding into cliches too.
lots of fun stuff though, like where are the police, and then a police person immediately slams into someone's face using the sign for crime prevention seminar to break into a building. Like, it's just lots of little good stuff. This is
also the amazing line where the policewoman says, stop shooting the civilians, that's for the police to do.
Yeah, great line.
It's a very slapsticky film.
Don't make me throw this hummus, it's spicy.
It's the most slapsticky film we've done on here, other than Monkey Bone.
Yeah.
On that note, where does it rank next to Monkey Bone?
Absolutely. Let's see where it goes into the top motion table. Okay, let's put this into our top motion table. Steph, I'll come to you first.
Okay, well, so at the moment we have Coraline in first for me, The Nightmare Before Christmas, Monkey Bone, and then James and the Giant Peach. I know I was supporting Monkey Bone, but I think this will have to go just above it. But not very close, to be honest. Like, I think out of those two, I would rewatch both of them. And so I think it's sitting just about third for me. Jake?
Yeah, for me, so it's Monkey Bone at the bottom, then... I've said this before, like, I feel like Nightmare Before Christmas, maybe in 20 years time when I've watched it loads of times, I'll really love it, but then it's probably Nightmare Before Christmas, then this, then James and the Giant Peach, then Coraline.
Yes, so despite everything I just said in the review section, I like this film a lot. I think it's a very solid and entertaining film, and the craft is off the charts, even if maybe it's going down a route in the craft that is straying away from what I enjoy in these films when we bunch them all together. So I'd probably put it on level pegging with James. So it would be maybe slightly edging ahead, because I think this is a bit more of a complete film for me than James. So it'll go Monkey Bone bottom, James, then Paranorman, Nightmare Before Christmas, Coraline still top for me. Oh, the iconography is in full effect. Next week we have the Box Trolls. We'll see where they land. Until then, keep up with us on social media. We are Ghibli Attack on Twitter, ghibliattack.pod on Instagram. Come follow us on Patreon for the ad-free episodes, footnotes from all of the research I do for The Context, and bonus episodes as well. We're going to be talking about The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, which features animation from Henry Selick in that period between Monkey Bone and Coraline. We're also all on Twitter individually. You can follow Steph at _StephWatts.
You can follow Jake at Jake H. Cunningham.
And you can follow Michael at Michael J. Leader.
But of course, before we go, we'd like to shout out a thanks to our recent Patreon subscribers. I'll run through these names now. Thank you to Gage Kushner, to Nathan, and to Daniel Webb. Go and check out our Patreon, patreon.com/GhibliAttack. We also have a Discord where we are talking about all sorts of things, including shouting out Jake for getting Simpsons episodes wrong on episodes that we recorded.
I have been humbled.
can you hazard a guess at the name of the title of the episode with Mr. Burns as the alien?
Oh, no. I really couldn't. But please hop on Discord. Tell me what the name of that episode is.
That famous Simpsons episode called I Bring You Love. We'll be back next episode with Box Trolls. Thanks for listening.
Ghibliotech is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Harold McShill, and Steph Watts. Our music is by Anthony Ng.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.